The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So welcome to Parkway Central and to the 5th Annual Philadelphia Book Festival. And my name is Siobhan Reardon, and I'm the President and Director here at the Free Library. Tonight kicks off our exciting 6-day book festival, packed with author events, musical performances, interactive workshops, and more. The festival culminates this coming Saturday, April 16th, at our lively outdoor street fair featuring more than 80 literary exhibitors and family-friendly programs and events in and around Parkway Central. If you've not been, please do come. It's an absolutely delightful event. Each day of the festival promises something for everyone, and I hope that tonight is just one of the many visits you'll be making to the Free Library this week. So be sure to pick up a festival guide if you haven't had one. Everybody have a festival guide? Wave your festival guys, everybody. Okay, and if you don't have one, there are certainly outside on the table outside the auditorium, and certainly upstairs in the lobby. If you've been to our past book festivals, you may notice a familiar pattern on the cute jacket I'm wearing. It's made from the 2009 Book Festival banner. These jackets are designed and made by Sava, an ethical clothing company based here in Philadelphia. And they'll be for sale each night, and so we can all go walking down the street together with our Way Cool 2009 banner. They're on sale all week long in the lobby, and a portion of the proceeds will be benefiting the Free Library of Philadelphia. So we have a limited number of jackets available and up in the lobby, so please purchase them. I'd like to thank our festival sponsors, Ruth and Morris Williams, Stradley, Ronan, Stevens, and Young, whose generosity has made this festival possible. I also want to thank our media sponsors, 6ABC, KYW News Radio, and the Philadelphia Media News Network, for helping spread the word about our incredible festival. Tonight's event with Garrison Keillor is generously supported by the Independence Foundation. Host and writer of Minnesota Public Radio's A Prairie Home Companion, Garrison Keillor is a storyteller, humorist, musician, satirist, and the author of more than a dozen books, including Homegrown Democrat, Lake Wobegon Days, Pontoon, and Liberty. A poetry connoisseur, he is the editor of Good Poems and Good Poems for Hard Times. And he hosts the American Public Media radio program and podcast, The Writer's Almanac, which features daily poetry readings. His new anthology includes selections from poets such as Billy Collins, William Carlos Williams, and Mary Oliver that celebrate different regions of the land of the free. It is a true pleasure and honor to have him here tonight. And ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Garrison Keillor.
Thank you so very much. Thank you very much. I never heard people whoop in a library before. I was brought up not to whoop under any circumstances. But I'm all in favor of your festival, and it's a great pleasure to be here for it. I'm all for festivity when it comes to writing, although for a writer, coming to a library is a serious, maybe even a grim moment. You walk past shelves of books in the deep stacks, deep storage, and here are all these writers that nobody reads. Oblivion, it's like a deep freeze down there. And why? What happened to them? They were a big deal in their own time, and large numbers of people admired them. They were famous writers. John Peel Bishop, he was a friend of F. Scott Fitzgerald's. High school sophomores read The Great Gatsby. They don't read John Peel Bishop. Nobody reads John Peel Bishop. Why not? Nobody reads Caroline Gordon. They read Flannery O'Connor. Why Flannery O'Connor? Why not Caroline Gordon? She was a good writer. What happened? You want to know so that you can avoid this yourself. Why go to all that work and then no readers? What happened? What happened? This is a serious question. Well, the answer is there's no way of knowing. There's no way of knowing. The heavy, mossy hand of oblivion rests on some people and not on others. How many people are actually reading Thomas Wolfe? He was a big deal back in the 30s and some of the 40s. I want to start out by reading you four poems for no reason. You can just sit through these. Talk among yourselves if you need to. Four poems by Walt Whitman, Kenneth Rexroth, Allen Ginsberg, and me. Four poets who are not usually all mentioned in one breath. And never will be again, but I love this poem by Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman died in Camden and lived for a time in Philadelphia. Walt Whitman. Once I passed through a populous city, imprinting my brain for future use with its shows, architecture, customs, traditions. Yet now of all that city, I remember only a woman I casually met there who detained me for love of me. Day by day and night by night, we were together. All else has long been forgotten by me. I remember, I say, only that woman who passionately clung to me. Again we wander, we love, we separate again. Again she holds me by the hand. I must not go. I see her close beside me with silent lips, sad and tremulous. Kenneth Rexroth, who was a Chicago radical, leftist, moved out to San Francisco, was sort of the stepfather of the Beats out there. Had a thousand political opinions, wrote political tracts, wrote some political poems, all forgotten now, all forgotten. Nobody would read them except graduate students. But he wrote love poems, and those are the poems that we remember. Spring rain. The smoke of our campfire lowers and coagulates under the redwoods like low-lying clouds. Fine mist fills the air. Drops rattle down from all the leaves. As the evening comes on, the treetops vanish in fog. Two saw-wet owls utter their metallic sobbing cries high overhead. As it gets dark, the mist turns to rain. We are all alone in the forest. No one is near for miles. In the firelight, mice scurry, hunting crumbs. Tree toads cry like tiny owls. Deer snort in the underbrush. Their eyes are green in the firelight like balls of foxfire. We walked through the stream, through woods and meadows full of June flowers. We chased frogs in the pools and played with newts and young grass snakes. I picked a wild rose for your hair. You brought new flowers for me to name. Now it is night, and our fire is a red throat open in the profound blackness, full of the throb and hiss of the rain. A strange new cottage in Berkeley. all afternoon cutting bramble blackberries off a tottering brown fence under a low branch with its rotten old apricots miscellaneous under the leaves, fixing the drip in the intricate gut machinery of a new toilet. Found a good coffee pot in the vines by the porch, rolled a big tire out of the scarlet bushes, hid my marijuana, wet the flowers, playing the sunlit water each to each, returning for godly extra drops for the string beans and daisies. Three times walked round the grass and sighed absently. My reward, when the garden fed me its plums from the form of a small tree in the corner, an angel thoughtful of my stomach and my dry and lovelorn tongue. Up in the sky, the lovers lay in bed, naked face to face and hip to thigh, her leg between his arm beneath her head, their hands roaming freely up in the sky. In the dark, Manhattan lay at their feet like a blanket of glittering stars thrown down. Beyond her bare shoulder, 59th Street, and from her lovely ankle, the buses headed uptown. They came to the city for romance, as people do, and with each other, they scaled the heights, and now, united, they lie at rest, these two, their boat gently rocking in a sea of lights. Where will they go? What happens next? I do not know. I am that man waiting at the bus stop far below. Love. The only good reason to write poetry. It's discouraging judging poetry contests. All the sad poems, poems about mortality. So is everybody else. Get a life. Don't tell me about it. I don't care. Tell me about what you most love. You don't need to say her name or his name. The passion of love comes through in poems. I love that poem by Walt Whitman. I love Allen Ginsberg writing about his little cottage that he rented in Berkeley, and he's pruning trees, and he's watering flowers and plants, and he's eating berries, and he's eating plums, and those plums make him think of the one he loves who is not here. I became a writer, I think, when I was a child. I was a very quiet boy. I wore glasses, sort of those ugly half-rim, horn-rim glasses. And I hardly ever made eye contact with people. And I was very quiet, and I stayed, and I went off by myself a lot, which back in the day they thought indicated brilliance. Nowadays, they'd say autism, but I thought that I was smarter than other children because I could spell really well, and I won all the spelling contests, and I read a lot of books, and I hung out at the library, so I thought I was smart. We took a car trip, my family and I was the middle child of six, and we took a car trip in our Ford station wagon out west to see Yellowstone National Park. I was interested to see Montana and Wyoming because I had read books about it, and had read Western romances. Zane Grey, I really liked a lot. Writers of the Purple Sage and so forth. Nobody reads Zane Grey anymore. He's probably way down, about 100 feet down there. Old pulp fiction. So we got in the car. This would have been in late June after school was out. And we headed off to the west on Highway 10, two-lane road, and rather narrow. This was before the interstate, so these were highways that were constructed back during the Depression when they were conserving on cement. No seat belts back then. Ralph had not come along yet, and so just rattling around, six kids in two seats, a lot of lateral movement back and forth, and pushing and tormenting, my father driving, my mother sitting up in the shotgun seat with a breadboard across her lap, so that we wouldn't need to waste money on cafe food, making bologna sandwiches, which she would pass back, and peanut butter and jelly as well. I sat in the middle of the back seat between my older sister and my older brother, and I was 11, 12 years old, and I was reading War and Peace by Tolstoy. I thought, since I was so brilliant, I should be able to read this, and I also wanted to impress my siblings, so I kept turning the pages, even though I couldn't remember who was who, Prince Andrei and Natasha and Pierre, and a lot of Russian names. But I kept turning pages, and onward we went. My father had a sort of a daily quota of about 600 miles that he needed to drive, so we wouldn't waste too much money on motels. We didn't stop at roadside plaques or anything of the sort. We just kept driving and eating bologna sandwiches until the needle, you know, was practically on empty, and we pulled into a Pure Oil station, which was just west of Jamestown, North Dakota. Pulled in, and the man came out to fill up the tank with gas. Back in the day before there was self-service, and there was a guy who would come out and do that and check your oil and check the tire pressure. And we went in to use the toilets because our bladders were aching. I was feeling carsick sitting there looking at Tolstoy's War and Peace in the back seat, and I felt as if I had to throw up, but I didn't want to do it in front of my family. We were just very self-conscious about bodily things. And so I waited until my father and my three brothers were done in the men's toilet. And then I went in. And when you postpone vomiting, it's hard to get back into the mood. So I waited a long time for something to happen, and I peed and waited to throw up, but it just didn't seem to be imminent. And so when I came out, they were gone. They had left. The worst thing you can imagine happening as a child, the proprietor was a guy named Al, and his wife, he and his wife, were sitting there in lawn chairs, the old kind, the steel kind with the scallops in the back, and under a canopy, which was by the pumps, and they were chain-smoking. He said, well, they'll be back. Don't worry about it. They called that night. They called. I was in the little green trailer, which was out behind the Pure Oil station, where Al and Lois lived, and they were chain-smoking back there and knocking back one beer after another. and they were watching professional wrestling on a little tiny black and white screen, the phone rang, and Al picked it up. He said, "It's your mother." This was, you see, back in the time when the telephone operator in Jamestown, North Dakota, would have been somebody from Jamestown, and she would have been in an office up above the drugstore and not in Kuala Lumpur or Bangalore. So she knew that I was there, and I picked up the phone. It was my mother. She said, "Are you all right?" What could I say? These two psychopaths were right there, and well, I guess. I said, "Where are you?" She said, "We're in Billings, Montana." I said, "That's a long way away." "Well," she said, "your dad just felt like driving." And I said, "You're coming back, aren't you?" She said, "Well, we talked about it." She said, "But if we came back for you now, then we wouldn't get to go see Yellowstone. So can we come back on Thursday?" Well, I was brought up to, you know, to, if people asked you how you are, you say, "I'm fine." I was brought up to be a stoic. I mean, I grew up in Minnesota, and, you know, where nature makes a serious attempt to kill you several times every winter. And, yeah, sure. So I spent the next 2 days there with Al and Lois. I learned how to pump gas, and I learned how to wash windshields, and it was the worst thing that you could imagine until it actually happened. And then what was the problem? This is a good preparation for a writer. And it gives you something to write about that your own family doesn't know about. They're not there. So you can write about Al and Lois. I started writing stories. I wrote stories about being loved by strange women who wanted to be with me, who wanted to put their arms around me, who wanted to dance with me, which we didn't do in our family because we were Christian people. And I wrote stories in which I was the object of the affection of girls who wanted to put their arms around me. My sister read one of these stories, my older sister, my tormentor, and she laughed. "Well, that never happened." Well, actually, part of it was true. Julie Christensen, who lived down the street from us and who played softball on a team that I played on our school team. She was a really good second baseman and kind of a long-legged girl, good arms, kind of big shock of blonde hair that she tied up in back. She and I were sitting on the grass that very summer and just sitting there the way people used to do, you know, before iPods and all of that. We just sat doing nothing. And she turned to me and she said, "Do you want to wrestle?" Which I couldn't imagine doing. I mean, I was brought up to revere women and the idea of grappling with a woman was unthinkable to me. I couldn't even think of what to say to her. And then she was on top of me and she got me and she got her legs around my waist in a scissors hold and she was strong. And she got me in a headlock, and she grabbed onto her wrist and I could feel her breath on the side of my head. I was writhing and trying to get loose and trying to roll backward to throw her off, trying to peel her legs away from me. And then while we were rolling around in the grass, It occurred to me, what does winning mean in this situation? Means nothing. It means nothing. So that part of it was true. Although when I tried to kiss her, she was repulsed by that. I don't know why. So my sister read this story of mine to her friends, and they all got a big charge out of it because I was, I was this strange child with the horn rim, half rim glasses and the home haircut, and shaved up high over the ears and hand-me-down clothes, some from my older sister, a pair of jeans that zipped up the side, and I became a writer somewhere back in that time. And also because I loved poetry, not so much poetry that you study and write term papers about, but the poems that people learn and recite. This was very common in my family. My Uncle Jack loved poems, and I loved my Uncle Jack, although he was a drunk. He was the town drunk, which was a great embarrassment to my family, and they were embarrassed to run into him on the street, which of course was pleasurable to me to see the embarrassment of my parents. My Uncle Jack once took me fishing on a summer night. It wasn't that summer. I think it was the summer afterward, which nobody had ever done before. I couldn't imagine an adult doing this, but here he was, and he came and he found me. I always slept on the day bed on our screened porch, and he woke me up, and it was the middle of the night. He said, "Let's go fishing. Fishing's good when it's dark," he said. I didn't realize then that this was the end of his day, not the beginning of it, but he was a little unsteady, but we drove down to the lake and we got out his green rowboat, which was in the weeds, and we washed out the sand. He hadn't used it for a while, and we pushed it down to the dock, which was out in the middle of town, the municipal dock by the swimming beach, and we got in. There was a little leak in it, and you could see water coming through some pinholes in the bottom, but I put my foot on it, and he didn't know it, and I wasn't sure I should say anything about it. He sat in the stern, and I sat in the middle. He had a couple of coffee cans with some worms in it, and a couple of cane poles, and he handed me the oars, and I put them in the oar locks, and I pulled away out into the dark. It was probably 4 o'clock in the morning on a summer morning. It was pitch black, just little fingers, rays of sun in the east, gold, pink sun coming up, and layers of fog out over the water. We pulled out and into what seemed to be the middle of the lake. It was pitch black around us. I just remember what it smelled like, the smell of alfalfa in the air, and the smell of dead fish and the water and grass, and the smell of the boat, and the smell of the coffee in his thermos, and his wild root hair oil, and he was smoking a cigar, and the flavoring that he poured in his coffee, and all. It was all so rich in this lilac vegetal cologne that he sprayed on himself. We sat there and we fished. And out of the dark came his voice. He said, "'Twas many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. And this maiden lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. She was a child and I was a child in this kingdom by the sea. But we loved with a love that was more than love, I and my Annabel Lee. a love that the winged seraphs of heaven coveted her and me. And that was the reason, as all men know, in the kingdom by the sea, that a wind came out of a cloud, killing and chilling my Annabel Lee, so that her high-born kinsman came and bore her away from me and shut her up in a sepulcher in a tomb by the sounding sea. But neither the angels in heaven above nor the demons down under the sea can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And the moon never beams without bringing me dreams of the beautiful Annabel Lee, and the stars never rise, but I see the bright eyes of the beautiful Annabel Lee. So all the night tide, I lie down by the side of my darling, my life and my bride, in her tomb by the sounding sea, in her sepulcher by the sea. Sat there in the dark, fishing, which is not necessarily good in the middle of the night. Sat there listening to Annabel Lee, and I could feel the water was up around my ankles. I wasn't sure I should say anything. Then he said, "Well, let's head in for shore." And we did. I pulled up to the dock, and I took the coffee cans and the cane poles, and I stepped out onto the dock. I should have tied it up, but did not. And he walked up the beam of the boat, my uncle, a little unsteadily from bourbon, and stepped up onto the middle seat and took a long step toward the dock. As the boat gently drifted away, he hung up there and then dropped into the water up to his rib cage. And didn't curse me, didn't cry out. He just walked into shore and stripped off his shirt and his pants, stood there practically naked, wrung out his clothes, put them back on, and he looked at me thoughtfully, and he said, "Well," he said, "if you don't get wet, then you haven't gone fishing." Which is an interesting law, something to think about. If you don't get wet, you haven't gone fishing. If you haven't suffered disappointment and doubt, then you weren't really a writer. I went to New York to be a writer when I was 24 years old. I took a bus. I was in serious trouble back in Minnesota. It was a good time to leave. This was in 1966. I was 24. You do the math. And I was engaged to be married to a young woman who I could now sense I was not really in love with. And I had written a letter in longhand on a legal pad to my draft board to tell them that I would not report for induction into the U.S. Army as they had ordered me to do after I passed the physical. So, one couldn't be in more trouble than that. A perfectly good time to get on a bus and go out to New York City and to stay in a rooming house, a boarding house, down on West 19th Street across from the General Theological Seminary in this very Hispanic neighborhood. All these poor people and traffic out on the streets, no air conditioning, sweltering hot summer in New York. And I walked around to write a piece about New York for the New Yorker magazine, who I'd been writing for years, but they weren't aware of it. And so I thought if I wrote something about New York, this would impress them. I spent 4 weeks in New York trying to write about a neighborhood that the longer I was there, I realized made no sense to me. I didn't know these people. There's machine gun Spanish going back and forth and prostitutes walking the street and grabbing at you as you passed, and people sitting on stoops and drinking something out of bottles in paper bags, and people who seem to be in arguments, and people yelling from upper windows, and small children running up and down the sidewalk in the middle of the night. I didn't know this city. I had no idea what to write about this. And so I had a great feeling of futility in New York. But I was rescued by a young woman who was also staying in this boarding house. And a young woman who took me for a long walk, and we sat in Central Park late at night, the park empty. No sensible people would have been there, but we were from the Midwest. We sat in the park, and she told me why she had come to New York. She came to New York because she lived in a small town, and she was the daughter of the Lutheran pastor, and everyone watched her in that town. It was a sort of town where you'd walk around and walk into the cafe, and the waitress would say, "You know, I liked those shoes you were wearing last week better than the ones you have on now." She came to New York for solitude. She came to New York to be alone, she said, so she could go out dancing. And she could dance with a boy, and if she wanted to make out with him, she could do that, knowing that people wouldn't be talking about this for the next 2 weeks. She said to me, "I'm only talking about necking," she said. "I'm not talking about having sex." She said, "I'm very particular who I have sex with." This thrilled me. This thrilled me to death. The fact that we were sitting shoulder to shoulder and thigh to thigh, or haunch to haunch, I should say. This thrilled me to pieces. And it made up for everything. Everything. Just as in the poem by Whitman, "Once I passed through a populous city," remembering, trying to remember all of these sights, holding them for some future use, but now all I remember of that city, that one woman who I clung to, who I sat next to. More important than the books that are in storage 4 or 5 stories down below us here are the poems that people carry in their heads and that they remember. My uncle remembered Annabel Lee. Robert Frost, people still remember his poems. "When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and think upon myself and curse my fate," is remembered by many people who have cursed their fate. But then they remembered the sonnet, number 29, by Shakespeare. To put something that remains in people's heads is an amazing, amazing idea. My mother is 96, and she persists, though her memory comes in and out. But sometimes she has tremendous clarity, as when she told me a few weeks ago, she said, "There are a lot of things I'd like to know," she said, "but there's nobody I can ask." which happens when you get to be 96. They're all gone. The people who might have some idea why Grandpa came over from Glasgow in 1905. We can't figure this out. He never said. Did he stay in touch with the family back there? We don't think so, but we don't know. We're not sure. My mother had a cartilage implant a couple of years ago, and because people in my family have a hard time with anesthesia, somehow the idea of painkillers goes against our nature, and we tend to hallucinate and get out of control. She wanted a member of the family to be there, and so I was available. So I went to sit with Mother as she went under the anesthesia, and they gave her a muscle relaxant, and she became very relaxed. And she started talking about Earl. I'd never heard about Earl. Who is Earl? Oh, you've seen Earl. Well, I haven't, actually. I don't think so. No, you have. I showed you a picture of him once. We were at the Syttende Mai celebration, the Norwegian Independence Day celebration, in Minnehaha Park in Minneapolis, and that would have been around 1933 or 34. And there's a picture of it. Well, now I could remember. I could remember. I had seen this. I had always been curious about it because there she was with her arm around the waist of a sort of a stocky fellow. He probably was in his 20s, wearing a white shirt and white pants and a black belt and white shoes. And his hair was very nicely parted down the middle. And he wore black horn-rimmed glasses, perfectly round. And he was there with my mother, who was very lovely, slender in her white summer dress, and they were looking at each other, and they looked as if they were about to dance, or they just had danced. Well, where was that picture taken? I said, "Oh," she said, "That was Syttende Mai," and we went there together, and I remember that we went swimming in the Mississippi. We walked down through the brush, and it was a hot day, and nobody was around, and though I'd never done this before, he turned his back, and I took off my clothes, and I went into the river, and then he took his off, and I looked. We swam, and I remember we held hands because the current was strong, and he put his arms around me. And then, I don't remember, we lay in the grass because we didn't have towels, and our clothes were hanging in the bushes, and we were afraid somebody would steal them, but we lay there in the grass, in the sun, and I don't remember what happened. Well, what happened to Earl? I said. Well, she said, we talked about getting married. But it turned out that he didn't believe in the resurrection. I thought he was Lutheran, but he didn't believe in the resurrection. He believed in reincarnation. But that's not the same thing. So I couldn't bring him home to meet Grandpa. And so we broke up. And then I met your father. And he was nice. Oh, she said, you remind me so much of Earl. Sometimes I look at you and it's like Earl is still here. He was a lot of fun. He believed in the wrong thing. Reincarnation, that makes no sense. But he was who he was. There's a lot I'd like to know, but there's nobody to ask. Well, there's why you write Friction, to answer these questions that nobody is around to answer. I'm going to leave it right there and see if you have any questions, if there's anything that I would know anything about that you care to ask questions about. There are people who are coming down the aisles carrying whips, small, small whips. So if there are no questions, we'll get this out of you. Yes, sir. You're a man in the second row.
I do have a question that I thought of when we were speaking earlier. You've been telling the stories of Lake Wobegon for 30 years now. Hmm. And I'm curious, what propels those stories along? You're decades removed from having lived in Minnesota. You live in a very different place. What gives the stories that you tell on your radio program such freshness and immediacy now?
Well, I appreciate you saying that, freshness and immediacy. They don't have freshness to everybody, first of all. I need to point out. To people from Minnesota, they're far from being fresh. And other people have found the stories useful to put children to sleep. I know of people, young couples, who have confessed this to me. They were a little, a little chastened to admit it, but they found that for infants and also children actually on up into their teenage years, stories of Lake Wobegon, just put them right out on long car rides. And sometimes made the driver a little drowsy, too. Well, what keeps the stories fresh, if they are fresh, what keeps them fresh for me is a sense of failure, a very keen sense of failure and disappointment. You have something clearly in mind that you want to pass on to people. And the story is very clear in your own mind. And then you walk out and you do it on a live radio show and you don't have a script because you don't want it to sound read, so you don't. And so you walk out and you just say it. And in the course of doing it, you lose, the smell of alfalfa. You lose the smell of the wild root hair oil. And it becomes sort of dry and weazened. And so, having failed that time, you're impelled to try to do it again. And that's what keeps you doing it for 34 years is... Is this sense of failure? If you could just impart to people what it felt like to climb up to the top of that mountain of hay bales, and Uncle Jim's farm, and how it felt to stand up there and to recite, "Oh Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done, the ship has weathered every rack, the prize we sought is won," and lose your balance and fall, slide down hay bales and down through the hole in the floor of the hayloft that we used to throw the bales down to the cows, and go through that hole and land in the bull's pen where the bull was kept, and you hit your head against the concrete barrier which was there to prevent him from mounting the cows when it was not time, and the bull was there, and he was pushing at you with his snout, and your Uncle Jim grabbed you by the ankles and hauled you out, and into the house and lay you on the sofa, and your grandmother put brown paper, moistened brown paper, on your head, and because you were so quiet, they thought maybe you had injured yourself, and should they take you to a hospital or not? And they deliberated this, and you lay there wishing that they would take you to a hospital, because you'd never been to a hospital before, and your family had never shown you this much attention before. And it concerned you how long they would still discuss whether or not to take you to the hospital. It's a complicated story. But I've never told that story on the radio because I just don't know that I could get it right, you know. People would be waiting for the punchline. Well, there is no punchline. It's a story which consists of context and texture. It actually happened, and maybe that's when I became a writer, was when I hit my head against the concrete. Who knows? Who knows? Yes. Was there another question? Yes, there is another question.
I'm deeply concerned about the trauma of your parents leaving you. And I was wondering what your psychiatrist says about that in terms of your life.
Well, I mean, it would be interesting to bring up to a psychiatrist. The only psychiatrist I really have talked to is an old classmate of mine. She was an English major, as I was, and then she went into medicine and into psychiatry and then into psychoanalysis. And there she is still in practice in Minneapolis. She's still doing talking therapy, you know, one of the last. She does not prescribe drugs for people. She just doesn't. And so we have talked about these things. But my God, Margaret has so many more problems than I do. you know, once you peel away some of the skin from the onion, she has a fascinating history, and I don't envy her at all. So it's hard to ask for help from somebody who has more problems than you do. It's like, you know, going out and trying to borrow money from homeless people. Well, we've certainly raised some interesting issues here. Any other questions from the back of the room, from the people sitting in dim light? Or? Oh, yes, yes.
I wanted to thank you for the good poems and for the Writer's Almanac. Uh-huh. Could you talk about how the Writer's Almanac came into being, and then I guess in terms of selecting the poems and whether people sort of funnel what they think you might like, or do you do a lot of your own reading around of contemporary poetry?
Sure, sure. The Writer's Almanac came about, just sprang out of my forehead, and it was one of those instant ideas, you know, that just comes to you. I wanted it to be 5 minutes in length, although public radio stations are averse to something that short. You know, they would rather it be 30 minutes. It just would fit their formats better. But I don't want to do a 30-minute program. I want it to be 5 minutes. I want to only ask for 5 minutes of somebody's time. And that seems to work really, really really, really well. The selection of poems is, I'm not interested in teaching you anything about American poetry. I'm not interested in, I'm not really interested in literature. I'm interested in poetry as clear speech. I want it to be clear because you only get to hear it once, you see. And people are busy in the morning, and they're yelling at their kids, and they're making scrambled eggs, and most people hear it in the morning, and I want them to get it in one hearing. I am not interested in blowing smoke in people's faces. I am not interested in showing off and reading some opaque, surrealistic poem as if I get it, so why can't you? I don't do that. I just don't want to go there. Here's a poem that I did on Good Poems. Caught on a side street in heavy traffic, I said to the cabbie, "I should have walked." He replied, "I should have been a doctor." Well, that's by a poet named Harvey Shapiro, but you know, there's no problem with that. There's no problem with that. That's a poem that qualifies. You can read, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock on your own, and this small, dank, damp mope fest of a poem that is forced on high school sophomores, and which has killed off the interest of more people in poetry than just about anything else. Do I dare to eat a peach? Do I dare to where my trousers roll? I don't give a shit. Do whatever you want to do. Eliot wrote these poems because he was trapped in a bad marriage. It was the most unhappiest marriage that anybody. She tried to commit suicide several times. She had nervous breakdowns. They didn't have sex for years. And later in life, Thomas Stearns Eliot met his wife. What was her name? Vivian, I think. And they loved each other. And he got to have a drink after dinner, and he started to tell jokes late in life. The man who gave us Prufrock, the man who gave us The Wasteland. April is the cruelest month, you know. Breeding memory out of desire. Okay, fine. Thanks. Thanks for the thought. He became a friend of Groucho Marx's late in life. If only it had happened earlier. You see? The future of poetry hangs on these things. A bad marriage and millions of people are tortured. Any other things I can clear up here? Anything else? Take care of? No? Anybody? Last chance. Last chance. Going. Yes? Yes? Where? Who? What? Yes.
When I was in college, Robert Frost would drop by every once in a while and sit with a bunch of us. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, someone would say, "When you wrote Stopping by the Wood, did you mean..." And he always gave the same answer. "If I'd wanted to tell you something, I would have said it there."
Uh-huh. Yeah. He was a foxy old guy, Robert Frost. He only gave you what he wanted to give you. I remember I saw him. He came out to the University of Minnesota about a year before he died. I guess he came out in 1961. He was so famous, of course, from having done his poem at John F. Kennedy's inauguration, the famous occasion where on live television in front of an entire nation, an old man was blinded by the sun and fumbled at the lectern. and could not read the poem he had written for the occasion, but instead recited from memory his poem, The Gift Outright, which was a great moment in literature to see a poet being a hero in public. He came out to the University of Minnesota and he packed Northrop Auditorium with 5,000 people, and we all sat and watched him do his show, his great performance, and he read all of his most popular poems, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, and he did The Gift Outright, and he did Fire and Ice, and I Have Been One Acquainted with the Night. He did them all. He was a great, great performer, and he lasts. He goes on. He goes on. He had any number of demeaning biographies written about him, and people, you know, told small, unkind anecdotes about him and his ego and his, you know, and how he treated the people he worked with and so forth, and his family problems, of which he had a truckload. Children who died in infancy, a daughter who tried to commit suicide and who had to be institutionalized, his son who did commit suicide, and all of this tragedy and all of these deaths. But the fact is that the man survives. His poetry survives, and I think it will. So, take a look, if you can, tonight. You can look it up online, his poem, Provide, and it'll teach you something. And I will just repeat the advice that I got from my Uncle Jack, good advice for any writer. If you don't get wet, then you haven't been fishing. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.